Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome in to the Bet the Board podcast, talking all things college basketball. 52 games in the books. 15 remaining before somebody cuts down the nets in San Antonio. I am your fearless leader, Todd Furman, joined as always by the man who does the heavy lifting around here. He brings the goods each and every time we get together, Payne Insider. How you doing over there, my friend?
I'm actually playing a little hurt today.
Oh, are you? Is it an injury you care to disclose? Or are we going to go NHL style playoff injury report where it's just an upper body or lower body injury?
If I was on the Don Best screen today, it would say probably thumbs dash pistachios.
I'm afraid to get context on this particular story that you're about to delve into here.
So I was telling you last night, I slept for crap. Somehow I passed out. It was like 9:30. You wake up at like 1 in the morning. Like, where are you? And I just couldn't fall back asleep. So I just remembered this morning as I'm setting up for this podcast, I see like a bowl of pistachios. Just like the shells. And I woke up and my fingers in my hands are like so sore. I didn't realize why until I just looked to clean up these pistachio shells. At like 3 a.m, I'm watching this Rob Gronkowski's like comedy show thing, just hammering pistachios. And so, I mean, I just woke up. My hands are freaking sore as hell.
I mean, is this a common occurrence that you wake up in the middle of the night not knowing where you are and you decide you're going to binge eat and binge watch bad TV? I mean, because if it is pain, we're a little concerned about you. And I'm sure a lot of the listeners could send suggestions to sleep therapists and different other homeopathic remedies to make sure you're getting your full allotment of 7 hours so you're able to bring the goods and make everybody money.
Is it 7? Is that the key? I was told 6. 6 to 8, that window.
I mean, I normally adhere to about 5, 5.5, which probably isn't ideal. I mean, as you can tell right now, I go out one night during the NCAA tournament with some of our media colleagues. It'll probably take me about 10 days to recover. So fight through a little bit of adversity. But my sleep schedule, I'm typically like a 12 to 5:30-ish guy.
Yeah, I try to get at least 6. All right, usually in that 1 to 7 range.
It's one of those things that you'd love to be able to try and bank during the slower times of year once we finish up the NCAA tournament, you know, April, May, June, July, August, before you have to basically run on 3 to 4 hours of steam, if that, during the busiest times of the year.
That's the goal. I can't wait to sleep.
I mean, hey, something to aspire to 2 short weeks from now. But before we get there, we do have some business at hand. For those folks new to the Bet the Board brand, you can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I, of course, am Todd Furman. You can follow me there as well at Todd Furman. And more importantly, follow the Bet the Board podcast at Bet the Board Pod for all updates. I know, Payne, you got a lot of questions, folks, going, hey, are you guys going to be back with a Sweet 16 edition? Apparently, our listeners don't always go start to finish when it comes to trying to digest all the great content we're bringing them.
Well, this is what we're going to do this week. It's going to be short, simple. We'll go over the 8 games, you know, try to touch on some key factors there. A couple minutes each game, try to get in and out here in about 45 minutes. Apparently, the 90-minute variety wasn't overly enjoyed. Everyone begs for content. When are you coming back? When are you coming back? We give them 90 minutes in the first time, I would say, since the Super Bowl. And people just don't listen to the whole thing. So we're going to try to make this quick.
I mean, maybe they're telling us we're more easily digested in shorter intervals and increments. But I have to imagine the folks that have longer commutes prefer, you know, that 90-minute diatribe that we'll go on. But either way, no sense beating around the bush. Before we get into the 8 games in the Sweet 16, I did want to get your take on what we saw over the first 4 days of the tournament. Outstanding for the sports books. I spoke to a number of shops. Some reported double-digit holds, 7-figure wins. I mean, you name it, everything went the way of the house, or so it felt. But in terms of surprises, a team that cost me dearly, not once, but twice. I mean, Nevada's impressive comeback, Syracuse winning 3 games to get to this round, and then a lot of the tight finishes. What really surprised you the most from your viewing?
Well, I'm glad somebody caught a break, because I certainly didn't. There's a lot of buzzer beaters.
Well, add me to that list. I'm right there with you, dealing with the same afflictions.
if you're talking Nevada, that really just irks me from this perspective. Is this the team that we were higher on than anybody? And I can go out there and say higher on them than anybody. I mentioned that last week. They had peaked at like 14th in our power ratings at one point, but then you lose Lindsey Drew to already a team that is just doesn't have a lot of depth. And then how they came back. You know, it's a team that doesn't have a ton of depth, yet late in the game, they just seemed really strong. And I think the one thing for Cincinnati, we saw them struggle a little bit in tight games throughout the course of this season. They had a couple guys, you know, four guys averaged double-digit points, but they didn't have anybody that could really take a game over late when it was on the line or get you a bucket when it was absolutely needed. But it seemed like Cumberland was that guy towards the end of the season. Then when he filed out 5 minutes to go, it was all downhill from there. But, you know, tip your caps. Musselman's got his guys going. I'm just stunned how they've done it. It'd be different if you got out to a lead and kind of held on. But coming from behind 14 and then 22 with the team with no depth and a point guard, that's pretty surprising to me.
And I mean, I think we're going to see the two Cinderellas, so to speak, between Nevada and Loyola. Obviously, a game we'll get to it in greater detail. Loyola doing it a very different way with last-minute heroics and big-time shots. So two of the better storylines to track. Unfortunately, three of their four wins came at our expense with Miami against Loyola and then fading Nevada twice. Your Orange, I mean, getting a big win against Michigan State. I'm not sure if we want to say that's a surprise from Syracuse or a disappointment from Sparty, a team a lot of folks picked to get to the Final Four and maybe have a great chance to win the entire thing.
A little bit of both. I think when you look at how Syracuse is made up right now, it's not going to be pretty. And I know everyone's throwing out these stats on social media, but it hasn't been pretty offensively all year. This is how Syracuse wants to play. They want to play these games in the 50s and 60s. And it's going to look ugly. They're getting a lot of contributions from a lot of their younger guys that are growing up, from Brissett to Dolezal. So that's been a huge part of it. But yes, when you look at Sparty, I thought there was a lot of weird things that went on in that game. Even though it was pretty close, at no point did you ever think Syracuse was going to pull it out. And then there was this spot where Sparty went up six. They missed a wide open three again, which seemed like the entire game. They were getting a lot of open shots and just missing them. And I think that's something we'll talk about when we break down Syracuse Duke. But they were just missing a ton of open shots. Izzo had some questionable substitution patterns. He didn't play Ward enough. There was just, I don't even know the kid's name. He's like a fifth year senior. He's got a knee brace, stuck him on in the middle of the zone, and his head's like an owl. As soon as he gets the ball in the middle of the zone, it's like, what am I doing with it? He doesn't know. You got to stick somebody in that zone that's competent, that's going to attack and be aggressive. Shocked Bridges didn't see the middle of that zone at any point in the game. And I think that's the biggest thing. Man, what a disappointment that is. I've seen him play a bunch this year, but on that stage, I mean, doesn't look overly athletic, doesn't look like he has a ton of burst, looks a little bit out of shape, isn't the greatest shooter. And I made a comment on Twitter that wasn't well received, but he looks like a poor man's Michael Beasley.
I was gonna ask
could
you
not draft him in the top 10.
That was going to be my follow-up question. You watch more NBA than I do. I mean, where does he translate the next level? So many people talking about him being the second coming, and I couldn't help but feel the same way, not only through two performances in the tournament. Yes, he looked explosive and athletic against Bucknell, but throughout the course of Big Ten play, he just disappeared for extended stretches, and you're like, if this is the kind of takeover talent at the college level, I should know when he's on the court at every moment of the game, like we see from superstars at this level.
He was left open multiple times to hit a shot. He missed a turnaround right-handed hook from about 4 feet at a crucial juncture late in that game. You would just think he missed a blew a layup. It's like he blew it. He got a flat tire there going up for a left-handed layup on the right side of the basket. But he just didn't have it to me. And, you know, I watched him a little bit in the Big Ten game. They played Wisconsin in the opening round. He had a great game there. But, you know, when you're shooting these 18-foot jump shots, how consistent can you be? So I just didn't see it from him. That was the biggest disappointment to that whole thing. Again, a lot of weird rotations for Izzo. Yes, they missed a ton of open shots, and that game goes dramatically different if they're hitting open shots they usually hit, and Bridges appears somewhat competent. But this is the tournament, single elimination, and here we go. We have Syracuse proving the committee's loving this. Last time the committee put Syracuse in.
Don't even get me started on that. Don't even get me started.
They're proving they're right again. I know you and Daylon, you know, are hating Syracuse, but the resume matched up, and there was other reasons we discussed at full length last time. But again, these are human beings. These aren't computers. And I think this is probably a good touching point. Like, Todd, if you've been in the corporate world before, if you referred someone 4 job, and they came out and they performed admirably, and you got praised for recommending this person, you're likely going to recommend them again. And it's the same thing for the committee. 2 years ago, they put this Syracuse team in the tournament. They were a bubble team, and they went on to a Final Four. So when you're sitting in that committee room and you're saying, listen, I'm between this team and this team, which one's going to make me look best potentially and prove me right? Syracuse is doing it again.
Well, I will say one thing about it, and I think what gets lost in the discussions, and I know we touched on it a little bit in the opening round podcast, it is a made-for-TV product, and Syracuse is a big brand. There are a lot of prominent alums throughout sports media, so them being included in the tournament, from that standpoint, I have absolutely no problem with. And you raise a great point. I mean, the pedigree is there. We've seen them where everybody counted them out because of the style of basketball they play. They're able to go out there, ugly up some of these games, and win not one, in this case, not two, not just three, but have a chance to maybe upset Duke as a double-digit dog if they're able to avenge that loss in late February. Aside from the disappointment we saw in Sparty, though, three other teams. I don't know if I could call them surprises, Payne, because I don't think we were high on any of them coming into the dance. Arizona, Xavier, North Carolina. I think maybe the margin of victory that North Carolina lost to Texas A&M, that might have been most alarming. Arizona, I don't want to say we saw Buffalo drubbing them coming, but we did talk about it. We said Buffalo was a team that nobody really appreciated. Arizona struggled to defend the perimeter. And you want to talk about a team that quit with 10 minutes to go? Sean Miller should be ashamed of what his team put forth.
I went on a limb with Arizona, and there's no mud on my face. So this is a team that I did not like. I kind of pounded the table the last podcast, said, hey, their best win's a neutral against Middle Tennessee State. Their best road win is maybe Utah or Oregon, two teams outside our top 60. So I didn't love anything they had done. Buffalo was a sneaky team. And again, when I referenced Buffalo as that being a tough game for Syracuse and putting them in the non-conference schedule, everyone kind of laughed. No one's laughing anymore. So I did not like Arizona. North Carolina, it is what it is. This was kind of a team that overachieved all year, didn't have the talent as they had in most years past. And if you can rebound the basketball, which A&M can do, and you can force North Carolina to play in the half court, Roy Williams at this stage in his career isn't going to draw up anything in a half court that's going to beat you consistently. And that's what we saw there. Xavier, I am a little stunned with how they went out. I said from the onset that this was a team that was extremely overrated as a one seed. We had them, I think, 15th in our power rating. So they weren't deserving of a one. But when you looked at their path, you said, oh, they should be able to win these games. They had FSU dead to rights, had double-digit leads twice. FSU ended on an 18-4 run once JP McCurry went out. That was lights out with 2 minutes to go. FSU smartly pressured the ball in both games. Very, very nice to see. And that's when they're at their best, when they can pressure the ball and get out and get easy hoops.
Yeah, it was crazy to watch Xavier melt down a team so well coached. You mentioned Makura falling out with a good amount of time left. You have what was supposedly elite-level guard in Trevon Blewett. You're supposed to be able to take games over, make the plays, but full credit to Florida State. And more importantly, Terrence Mann going out there, gutting it out, Florida State's leading scorer to get the Noles into the Sweet 16. Again, though, we'll get into Florida State's prospects to get the Elite Eight as we break down some of the big games. And Payne, I feel like we may as well go in Don Best rotation order here and start in the South, where it's Kentucky, a 5.5-point favorite, total 138.5. In a matchup of a pair of Wildcats. Kansas State, a pretty favorable road, drawing UMBC in the round of 32. Much to my chagrin, not covering as a double-digit favorite. But I guess we should start with the injury status of Kansas State's leading scorer. Do we think Dwayne Wade, in the 16.5 points per game and over 6 rebounds per tilt, will be out there and at all serviceable for Bruce Weber's bunch?
Not to go back to that game, but there's a couple free throws late there for you that could have.
Oh, they could have pushed that game to 11, those sons of bitches. And then UMBC comes down. They don't even follow UMBC's final shot. I thought the game ended 9. And then apparently I look later, the game ended 7 because the shot went in. I might have been a little bit more on tilt, given some of the frustrations earlier in the day watching Nevada meltdown. And as you alluded to, some of the games that didn't quite go our way on Thursday.
And it was big because there was some 9.5 available there, too, after the initial surge. So that was interesting. I'm sure some folks had 9.5 in that spot as well. Everything that I'm hearing and I saw, and there were some great articles out there that you should have been reading. If you're listening to this podcast, looking for updates on Dean Wade, he says he's 98% sure he's playing. This isn't a game that he's willing to miss. If you've done some research, he did warm up for both the Creighton and UMBC games. I would think some of Wade is better than nothing. It is a stress fracture in his foot, so I think his conditioning could probably be affected, not having played in what will be, I don't know, over 2 weeks now. I did speak to a doctor yesterday, and he said, like, this is an injury that you have to stay off your feet. It takes 5 to 6 weeks, best case scenario, 6 to 8 weeks to heal usually. But that's to fully heal. You can absolutely play through this if you can manage the pain. So I would envision he's probably going to get a shot for this one. The other interesting factor here is Calipari hinted that there's a possibility of Jared Vanderbilt coming back for this one. So that would be big. When you look at this number, I don't think we get much lower. In fact, with the public and the potential of Vanderbilt being upgraded on the screen, I could see this potentially getting back to six.
It'll be interesting to watch the number. I mean, we've talked about it at great length. Sometimes market entry can be rather challenging during the NCAA tournament because, much like the NFL, the public has their say, and books don't necessarily want to put themselves on an island, knowing that even if there is a professional appetite, given what will go on. When I look at Kansas State, Payne, they don't wow you with anything to do offensively, the Creighton game notwithstanding. I mean, they look pretty pedestrian in the half court. How do you think their ability to get easy buckets or something against this Kentucky defense, it's really upped its level of play, and some of the athletes that Coach Calipari will throw at them on the perimeter?
That's going to be the big thing. Kansas State is going to have to find some offense. They're going to have to be more efficient, less than a point per possession against UMBC. That's not going to work here. But from what I was able to watch, Kentucky left a ton of guys open in their first two games. If I hadn't watched them, I would have thought, hey, great defensive performances. But I watched both Davidson and Buffalo just had really poor shooting nights. And I'm not sure if that's going to happen here. I mean, Kansas State isn't, you know, elite from the outside. But there was a lot to be had there on that Kentucky defense, which shocked me a little bit. Maybe we see as good as the SEC has been, not a ton of great offense, so they're great defensive numbers, you know, a little bit helped by the SEC conference. The big factor for me here is Kansas State, defensively, they're going to have to rebound. Maybe Wade helps that a little bit. Kentucky likes to crash the glass. We saw that against Buffalo. They really took advantage of being undersized there and some early foul trouble on some of the big guys from Buffalo. So that second chance offense from Kentucky, you're going to have to slow that down. So, you know, there's some things here that you know, matchup wise, Kentucky looks pretty good. But I can tell you K-State is the professional side here without question. I think there's two guys that can help Kansas State, and they're going to need them both. I was looking at this. Mike McGrill had like 13 points all season. He's a freshman. He's one of the better freshmen. I think he's going to be a big player for K-State, but he had 19 combined the first two games of the tournament. So I think he's going to start getting more playing time there. He got some confidence in the Kansas game. I know that was a blowout in the conference tournament, but Brown went out with the eye, and it looked like, you know, he gained some confidence a little bit. The other guy is McCall Maween. He's been killing it. He's averaging 15 points with Wade's absence. So if you can get those two guys in addition to Brown and Wade, you're going to have a real shot here. My number on this game, I think, was 4.5. So there is some value here. And again, you know, we talked about key numbers last week, and it just dawned on me now because I mentioned Davidson. Heroic cover. Like, it was a magical cover without question. But I am just such a big believer in creating your own luck. And when you can take 6 on a game, we told you key numbers 5, that game, it would paint quite the picture if it closed below 5. And it did. It closed 4, 4.5. And so certainly a lucky shot there. But if you're able to get 6 or 5.5, you cash that ticket. And, you know, a lot of people just, you know, just pick the winner. And that holds true a lot of times for these tournaments. But, you know, when you're looking at 100-game sample size, the difference between being a professional bettor and punching a time clock is 3 games. And a game like Davidson hitting that shot where you created your own luck by taking 6 goes a long way in becoming a professional bettor.
Yeah, and I don't even want to talk about taking the best of the number because the game we gave out on South Dakota State, I moved early, took 8 there. Game falls 8, knowing there's some 8.5 on game day. But I digress.
Yeah, hopefully everyone got a push. So, I mean,
yeah,
that's how we're going to count.
Listeners should have had a push.
Absolutely. And in that worst case situation, you got 3 hours of entertainment absolutely free. Yes. But if you listen to the podcast on game day from like what I did there.
I appreciate that.
9:37 in the morning Eastern time to like 1:01 p.m. There was 8.5 out there. So hopefully, you know, some people got 8.5 as well.
Every now and again, our late listeners, our Johnny Come Latelys, are rewarded. You mentioned Kentucky. I mean, winners are 9 out of 10. They've rattled off a 9-1 against the spread clip during those 10 games. Professional money on Kansas State. Last thing here, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander for Kentucky. Does Kansas State have to make him the focal point if they're going to neutralize what Coach Calipari's team wants to do offensively?
I think so. He has been coming on of late, obviously. I think Brown's going to play a huge role in that. He might be a little smaller, but that could frustrate him because he's lanky, not your traditional point guard. So if you can get under him, that could confuse him and frustrate him a little bit. Kentucky didn't get much out of Monk in the Buffalo game, was in some foul trouble. Again, the professional side here is K-State. They're going to have a home run effort without question. I can tell you when I looked at this a little bit, what makes me nervous is K-State hasn't shown an ability yet this year to beat elite teams. We have them right now 0-8 against our power rated top 25, and they've lost those games by an average of 16 points. So they haven't been overly competitive in the tougher games aside from that trip. I think they took a trip to Allen Fieldhouse early in the year, lost that by one. But aside from that game, they haven't been overly competitive when they step up in a class. This will be an interesting game, but six was the professional side. It's now five, even trending, 5.5, trending towards five. So this, I'm not quite sure where this is going to go.
And keep in mind, it should feel like a Kentucky home game in Catlanta, knowing how well the Lexington faithful will travel just a little bit south. To the nightcap in Atlanta, pitting the two Cinderella teams, Loyola Chicago against Nevada. This one of the bigger moves since the number opened, 2.5 on the open, now down to 1.5, even some ones starting to pop up through the market. More improbable entry. I know Nevada, Payne, you said earlier in the show how highly regarded this team was, peaking at number 14 in your power ratings. But without Lindsey Drew, they've been a little bit different given the road they've taken. But Loyola, no stranger to late heroics, getting a timely three-pointer against Miami. And then, of course, a little runner in the lane to get through Tennessee. Which team, in your opinion, might be better suited to handle prosperity? And more importantly, how much further do we think this number can travel?
Yeah, both these teams just fortunate to be here. So there's no real, you know, situational angle. You get two buzzer beaters for Loyola. The Miami game, they led for 0.3 seconds in the second half. And then Nevada, you look at them, 23 minutes of good basketball out of 85. So, you know, it's a team without its point guard. It's a team that lacks depth somehow. They've been able to overcome 14-point deficit. And then on a quick turnaround, 22 the following game. So I can tell you three minus $1.20 was the professional side here. I think Porter Mosier is fantastic. And if you know anything about how he's come up, this is a Majerus disciple. He was an assistant to Rick at St. Louis. And if you had to pick a team out of the remaining 16 that runs the best half court stuff, it's Loyola Chicago, and it's not close. There's contrasting styles here. Nevada wants to get up and down. Loyola, 319th in the country in adjusted tempo. I believe, especially this time of year, it's much easier to slow a game down than speed one up.
When you look at that, I mean, the total obviously suggests it could be played more to Nevada's liking in the 140s. I mean, we've gone through some of what Loyola has done. They've played seven straight games under the total pain. This will be only the second total in a game they've participated in the 140 since February. Does that tell us a little bit more, or do you think this is just built on Nevada looking to try and push tempo a little bit, that if Porter Mosier and his team are able to slow this thing down, keep it in the 60s like they've done twice already, it could be a slam dunk as far as finding a little bit of wiggle room there?
Well, I think Loyola runs great offense. They get open looks. They're seventh in the country in effective field goal percentage, so they score the ball too. Now, it's led by their defense, and I think that's going to be the matchup here, right? You face Tennessee, so you're thinking, okay, athletic team plays in the SEC. You played Miami, athletic team that plays in the ACC, but there's not a ton of skill on either of those teams offensively. And I think Nevada's a little bit differently. You got four or five guys that are all 6'7", they can all handle the ball, they can all shoot, they can all dribble penetrate, they can create their own shot. So this is a little bit different of a beast. That would be my lone concern here with Loyola Chicago defensively. But, you know, I'm not gonna buck who's on Loyola Chicago here. It's an extremely sharp position. So for me, it would be Loyola Chicago or pass. I don't have anything on the game at this point, but that's the way I would look. I do think the one advantage here for Nevada, and I know we've kind of harped on it, and maybe we're a little wrong. You know, we've talked about depth, and I've kind of been adamant, you know, come tournament time, depth really isn't needed. I just, there's more media timeouts. The timeouts seem to be longer. It really, you know, if you have a 6-7-8 man rotation, you're going to be completely fine. So if there wasn't fatigue, you know, coming back from 22 on a quick turnaround, you get 4 days off here. I'm not sure fatigue is going to play a role. Where depth comes into play is, you know, you get a guy in foul trouble and all of a sudden, you know, you don't have another guy to turn to, or someone goes cold and you kind of just try to make something stick. You could bring a guy off the bench to maybe create a spark. But in terms of fatigue, I'm not sure we're going to see that here from Nevada in the first game after 4 days off. This is now the AAU world, right? These guys are playing multiple games in multiple days with these tournaments on Saturday and Sunday. So I think fatigue's less of a factor, especially this first game.
And you mentioned that Nevada, of course, using a primarily five-man rotation. Halas Cook will come in to spell some of the starters should anybody get into foul trouble. Look at Loyola. This team, 22-9 against the spread through 31 games this season. 19-6 against the spread when facing teams with a winning record. One last thing on this particular game, Payne. Wanted to ask you about the travel situation. Do we assume Nevada just stayed east rather than returning to Reno, and Loyola making the short trip from Nashville down to Atlanta, pretty much keeping their body clocks the same?
That's what I've been told, yeah.
Okay. Always important to keep in mind when we talk about the kids and knowing that they're student-athletes, that they won't set foot on a college campus for as long as they're playing meaningful basketball in the month of March. But from the south, we'll head out west where it's the Michigan Wolverines. Lucky to be here, in my opinion, with that last-second big-time three-pointer against your beloved Houston Cougars, a 2.5-point favorite. Total of the game, 136 against the Texas A&M Aggies. And I guess first things first, Payne, the Aggies win against North Carolina. A real performance and indicative of what we're going to see going forward, or a little bit of fool's gold given some of the frailties we've seen from the Tar Heels this season?
It was a real win. I mean, they kicked their ass. You can't take anything away from that.
Well, no, but I'm saying, like, is that the kind of, I mean, this is a Texas A&M team we've seen at their absolute best, but we've also seen them struggle mightily against inferior competition. So calling them uneven performance-wise, I mean, I don't feel is that much of a leap of faith.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's basically when they get better play out of their guards, they become really good. Starks is a bit inconsistent. He's a freshman. Doesn't make the greatest decisions. They turn the ball over a ton. And that's when you get the inconsistent performance from them. But they have talent. They're athletic. They can play inside out. And it looks like Tyler Davis took a next step in this tournament. And that, I think, is going to be the big matchup in this game, because there's potentially two matchups that will determine this. I think Tyler Davis should feast again down low. And if, God forbid, Wegner gets in foul trouble, this game could be over. On the opposite side, I don't think we're going to see Tyler Davis attempt to guard the perimeter. I think you're going to see more of, you know, Trosha Morales and Robert Williams. They're going to have to be the guys, I would think, with their athleticism and length and, you know, ability to move and laterally, they're going to probably handle the responsibilities of guarding Wegner out top on the pick and pop. So I think those are the two matchups in this game that you're really going to want to watch.
What do you make of Michigan's struggles through the first two games of the tournament? Now, I know they did cover against Montana, but that may be Grizzlies' ineptitude more than anything else. And then, as we mentioned, needing some things to go right for them in the waning seconds to get through Houston. I mean, this is still a team that's won 11 in a row, 13-14. And during that 11-game win streak, Payne, 9-2 against the spread. So they've obviously been lining people's pockets. And they're, of course, doing it with defense. They've only allowed more than 70 points twice during that streak. And one of those comes with an asterisk, an overtime win against Iowa to the tune of 77-71. Do the Wolverines have enough size in the interior to slow down Texas A&M and some of the talented bigs that they're going to throw at the offensive glass?
There were some reservations for me on Michigan, and I kind of alluded to this on the opening round podcast for this tournament. I said, listen, Michigan's a team that's probably going to do enough to survive in advance, but I think they're probably not going to cover these spreads. And so far, 2-0. As they advanced, but 0-2 against the spread. Their power number got a little high on them after a great Big Ten tournament. To me, they don't have a ton of depth. To me, they become completely different if Wegner's in foul trouble, which is a possibility here. If he's going to be the guy guarding Tyler Davis in the post, that would concern me a little bit, as I mentioned that matchup a little bit earlier. I think this game comes down to, because Vegas says it's going to be a close game, right? Which team hits their free throws? At this stage in the Sweet 16, when you have a possession spread, this little stuff is the stuff that really matters. Neither team hits free throws. One team's 320th in the country. The other's 328th. The difference could be Michigan simply doesn't turn the ball over. And I alluded to this, Texas A&M with their true freshman point guard. He turns the ball over a little bit. That could be a big factor here. I can tell you it looks like the public and professionals are on the same side here, taking 3.5 or 3. Texas A&M does have some experience. One thing I was reading that kind of intrigued me a little bit more here is four of A&M's top six guys, you know, they're seniors and juniors. And I've listened to a lot of these press conferences this week, and I think it tells you a lot. But they were in the 2016 tournament. And they, if you remember, I think it was Northern Iowa. They had that like heroic comeback. They were down 12, I think, with like less than a minute. And they're talking about how they're on such a high after that. And they threw up an absolute dud against Oklahoma the following game. And they've talked about how they've kept even keel. They didn't want this, you know, 20-point blowout of Carolina to linger on in the next weekend. So I think that experience will also play a role here. So I think Texas A&M's the side here. I like Michigan. You know, value-wise, it's tough for me to fully get to the window with A&M, right? You get that big 20-point victory over UNC. Michigan looks horrible in both their games. Very slow starting against Montana, which we kind of expected, right? They hadn't played in 11 days. You know, you can do all the things, bring in referees and scrimmage each other and you know, go 2 days on and one off for rest. But that early stage of the Montana game looked like they hadn't played in 2 weeks. And I'm not taking anything away from the Houston game. I know you had to hit a buzzer beater, but Houston is really good. Like, really, really good. Like, the winner of that game could have potentially went to the Final Four. So them having to hit a late shot to beat Houston isn't something I'm going to discredit them for.
One last thing on the game. When you look at the two men manning the sidelines, John Beilein against Billy Kennedy, we give the edge to Beilein, yeah, or we think Kennedy can kind of bridge that gap a bit?
Yeah, Beilein in a tournament setting, he's as good as they get.
Should be fascinating to see that game unfold. Of course, it'll be one of the early tip-offs at Staples, followed by the nightcap pitting Florida State against Gonzaga. Gonzaga, 5.5, even some 6 starting to pop up throughout the market. You've seen some under money come in here. Total open 154, 155 in some locations, down to 152.5, some 153s out here. We mentioned the Seminoles' impressive comeback. They finished the Xavier game on that 18-4 run. Despite looking like they were dead and buried, how do we begin to handicap the Florida State Seminoles' Jekyll and Hyde performances? Because they look great against Missouri as well, but we know sometimes this is a team that's filled with basketball players that have heads for boxes of rocks.
That was a nice way to put it. You know, listen,
I was trying to articulate it the best way and not be, you know, really denigrating towards anything they do, because we talk poorly about Ham off the air in great detail, but the simple fact is this team is arguably one of the more talented teams year in, year out. Now, realizing their potential, obviously a much different story.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at this, Florida State, they're one of the fastest paced teams left in the tournament. And when they're pressuring you defensively and getting out and running or peeling it off the rim and advancing with tempo, they can beat anybody, right? We've seen it early in the year. They had a big win against Florida and then UNC. When you get them in the half court setting in a slowed down game, they're probably not one of the top 50 teams in the country. And I think that's why we see them so inconsistent. They don't run anything that strikes fear in you. They don't really have polished skill sets outside of Terrence Mann. You know, there's probably not a lot of guys on that team with a great basketball IQ on the floor for Florida State outside of Terrence Mann. But if this game is played at tempo, and they don't have to think, and they can use that size, their length and athleticism, they're going to be a tough out. And you kind of alluded to Ham here. And listen, great recruiter. It's rare he doesn't get his man. But, it's really not Leonard Hamilton here versus the other coach. I think, you know, a lot of people don't talk about this, but it's Stan Jones. He's the lead assistant. He's the brains of the operation. He's been with Ham for 22 seasons now. I think he's responsible for a little uptick in their tempo in recent years. Very good decision there against Missouri to press a little bit and go pressure. But Gonzaga plays the second fastest tempo in this tournament. So it'll be interesting to see if Gonzaga tries to employ the tempo or with 4 days of prep, they figure out it's better served to keep this a half-court game.
I want to ask you about Gonzaga because, I mean, you guys have obviously been much higher on the Zags than anybody out there. I mean, this is a team now favored to win the Western Region. I think I've seen prices a shade better than even money, plus 130. And you talk about Mark Few and what he's done year in, year out with this team. Top 15 this season in offensive and defensive efficiency. You look at some of the balance that they get offensively with Jonathan Williams, Josh Perkins, Zach Norvell, I think really has burst onto the scene, a player that most of the country probably doesn't watch game in, game out. And for me, almost that X factor coming off the bench in Rui Hachimura, do we think Gonzaga is going to be best served to turn this into a half-court slugfest and just kind of wear down some of that Florida State defense, looking to get good shots and running, you know, 15 to 20 seconds off, hoping that there's the defensive breakdown to get a layup at the rim?
I think you want to be who you are, but you can do it in certain little spells. Like, I don't think you want to go full-blown tempo here, but when the opportunity is there to strike, go for it, take the easy hoop. You mentioned Hachimura. He's their sixth man, but he was first team all conference. So I think
kid's tremendous. I'll say for anybody that hasn't watched Gonzaga in great detail, he's one of those guys that kind of jumps off the page of you with his athleticism and his ability to do a number of things, both on the offensive and defensive.
And he's kind of the forgotten about guy. You know, he had the huge coming out party on the national stage in the Ohio State game, but before that, the last two games, he wasn't very good. He wasn't good in the Greensboro game. He wasn't good in the conference championship game against BYU. I think he's going to have to play well when you talk about that athleticism. You talk about that length. I know he's only 6'8", 6'9", but he's athletic. He can jump. He's got the wingspan. So I think he's going to be a big factor here, especially when you talk about, you know, potentially on the offensive glass. Florida State doesn't do a very good job rebounding the ball defensively. They don't do a good job guarding the perimeter either. But, you know, on the offensive glass, Hachimura could have a field day here. I still think Norvell is the leader of this team. They go as he goes. He brings that energy, that intensity. He's got effort. He's really tough. And again, I was listening to Few talk this week in his presser, and he was talking about Norvell and said, listen, this probably doesn't come as a surprise this day and age and, you know, where we're located, but we have a lot of introverts on our team. But this kid is a city kid. He's from Chicago. He's extremely outspoken and he is vital to our team. And what that means is he's vital to a West Coast team that's a little bit of soft. And I think that's key in a game here against Florida State because Florida State will try to punk you. So Norville's going to be a huge key to this game.
Where, in your opinion, does this number go, or have you seen any professional money come trickling in on either side?
I have not heard anything yet or seen anything yet on this game. There was some slight talk about Gonzaga. Certainly, you're going to have to factor that home court advantage in. Florida State basketball isn't going to travel overly well, but when you get Gonzaga playing in the Staples Center on the West Coast, it's going to be predominantly Zags fans up and down. So you're going to have to factor that into the number, and if you do, it is a little short, so you could see that. And again, I kind of hammered this home on the last podcast. It's all about price. It's all about matchup. And I know, you know, I had Xavier advancing in my bracket, but a couple people had said, oh, like, you know, you had FSU, you know, winning that game or losing that game. And yeah, in my bracket, I did. But the price is the ultimate equalizer, right? That's the biggest thing here. So, you know, I actually made that game 4. So I'm not going to run and bet Xavier into an inflated number at 5.5 or 6. So I stayed off that game. But this one here, you know, when you factor in the home court advantage, if Gonzaga is smart and slows this down a little bit, they should have some advantages on the offensive end, not just running their half-court stuff, but those second-chance opportunities as well. Some of those guards should have open opportunities to hit shots. They like to pressure you, Florida State, but they do get lost in their assignment at times and give up some open shots. So if Gonzaga plays it that way, where they're calculating when they get out and run and sticking to the half-court and not forcing, you know, getting out and running, they're going to be fine here.
That may be a kind way to put it when you talk about Florida State's defensive breakdowns for anybody who's watched this team in great detail. I will say one thing, Payne, for those listeners hoping for 45 minutes in and out, they're going to be sorely disappointed because we're providing more content than they originally anticipated. So we'll go from Thursday to Friday into Boston, where Villanova, of course, the number one seed in the early game. 5.5-point favorites, number trending towards 5, taking on West Virginia. Total in this game, 152.5. I mean, we talked about it at great lengths. West Virginia, one of the more underseeded teams in the tournament. They get the fortuitous bounce of having to take on Marshall instead of Wichita State. Although after having watched the Shockers bow out of that game, I think West Virginia could have beaten them by 40, given the lack of toughness from Greg Marshall's team. When you look at Nova, can we make the case that this is one of the more difficult matchups that West Virginia could have possibly seen, given their depth at guard and their ability to protect the basketball?
Absolutely. We've hammered this home. You know, West Virginia's a top 10 ball club. Been screaming this from the heavens the entire year. Again on Selection Sunday, again last week, and again today after, you know, two blowout performances in round 1 and 2. This is a very, very good West Virginia team. When I'm looking at my power number right now, this is just a tick, and I mean a tick high at 5.5. I can tell you, regardless of what the screen does, West Virginia is the professional side, as they have been the first two games in this tournament. However, this to me is a tough on-court matchup for me. You know, when West Virginia's hitting shots, they can be the best team in the country because when the ball is going through the hoop, you know, the Mountaineers can get their press set up. If it's not going in the hoop, despite Huggy, who's quite crazy, he has no problem pressing off a miss sometimes. It's just not the same team. So, you know, the first things first, I don't believe West Virginia is going to score the ball as easily as they have against Murray State and Marshall. Carter's been fantastic. He's been hitting shots. We've seen, though, in games where there's elite opposition at the point guard position, a lot of his energy goes to defense, and that could be the case here, and it hinders his scoring a little bit. When West Virginia does score, I don't know how effective their press is going to be. You know, Brunson in that four-guard lineup kind of make them press-proof. If that press is broken, I don't think West Virginia's, like, packing in defense is going to work against a good shooting team like Villanova. Now, we've obviously seen cold nights in the tournament from Jay Wright's team, and they've left these tournaments and been knocked out early. That could certainly happen here. But when I look at this matchup going in, you look at West Virginia, 300th in the country defending the perimeter, and that three-point shot. So for me, it just feels like there's a lot of ifs for West Virginia to win here. If they're hitting shots, you know, if the press works, if they can defend the perimeter. And that's why I haven't played West Virginia just yet.
Oh, and oh, by the way, Villanova only hit 31 three-pointers through the first two games in wins against Radford and dominating fashion against Alabama. You mentioned West Virginia. I think one thing that gets lost on a lot of people, we typically pick on their inability to close out games, and rightfully so, given the meltdowns we've seen countless times. This is still a team off on the offensive side that's top 15 in efficiency, actually better on that side of the ball this season than they are defensively. But you hit on the key point that I wanted to get across. I mean, this is a team that struggles to defend the perimeter against teams. You know you're going to get open looks, and if Villanova takes full advantage of that, I'm curious to see how West Virginia is able to try and negate some of that edge, knowing that it's not just one player for Nova that can beat you from deep, but a variety of different guys that can be that assassin.
West Virginia's first time or first shot offense is respectable. Where they really get you is they got that length. They got some maulers. They like to punch you in the face. They like to punk you a little bit. They are fantastic as a second shot offense. They really hit that offensive glass. So if Villanova can do a good job stopping the initial shot and getting the rebound, this matchup is really tough for West Virginia, and I love West Virginia more than anybody.
Well, here's a key trend for you that's absolutely useless in the grand scheme of things, but always fun to talk about. Last 15 times, West Virginia has been pegged as an underdog. This may speak to their inability to score consistently. 12-3 to the under in those games against the quote-unquote superior side. From the early game into the night game that sees Purdue, a 1.5-point favorite against Texas Tech. Total in this game, 137.5. I guess the first question I have to ask you in handicapping this one, Payne, what kind of adjustment required for Purdue given the absence of Isaac Haas, who, depending on which accounts you read, the Purdue engineering team's trying to come up with a brace, other folks saying that there's no chance Haas will be out there. If he is or isn't, how much does this impact what Purdue wants to do at not only the offensive, but also the defensive end without their talented 7-footer?
You will lose. Oh, man, I just every time I look at him, it's like Ivan Drago all over again. You will lose.
Give him some boxing gloves. Let him get out there in the ring. He'll have the reach advantage over just about anybody.
I hinted at this last week, and maybe I will be proven wrong, but I don't think Haas is a completely debilitating loss here. I truly don't. I think this allows Purdue to go a touch smaller. It allows them to be more athletic. I think this means more touches for, the law firm of Edwards and Edwards. It means more of their best shooter in Dakota Mathis being on the floor. And I think Harms is significantly better defensively. He's more mobile. That's not even close. So when you just look at this matchup against Texas Tech or potentially facing Villanova's four-guard lineup, Purdue wouldn't have had a prayer defending either of these teams with Isaac Haas out there. So I think we've seen something like this before where Purdue with Haas on the floor didn't have a prayer against guarding Michigan, right? It was just a bad matchup. So this might be a blessing in disguise. I truly believe that.
When we talk about the number, and we'll get to some of Texas Tech's strengths and weaknesses, the win against Florida was the first time that Tech had covered a game in 9 tries. Do we think the market is overvaluing the Red Raiders by how well they played early on in the Big 12, or was that more of a reflection of the market not taking into account Keenan Evans struggling, despite the fact he's now dropped 20-plus points in 4 out of his last 5
games? He's healthy now. So multiple things here. Their power number got a little high at the beginning of conference, and then their schedule got a little tougher towards the end, right? They had to play West Virginia twice. They had to play Kansas. They had to play Oklahoma State, who probably deserved to be in this tournament when you figure, you know, who the teams they've been able to beat this year. Baylor significantly better than people think. So the schedule got tougher as their power number got higher. And then their horse was out. And it's really a young team around Keenan Evans. He's kind of got to be that guy. I know Zaire Smith has had a big tournament so far, but you know, he's a freshman. So Keenan is the guy here. That's an interesting matchup with Edwards. I don't know how they're going to attempt to defend Keenan. But I do think Harms is a big get in this game, just because when you're facing a team that plays small, his mobility on defense, they're just significantly better Purdue defensively with Harms in there. So again, blessing in disguise here. I have no idea on this game. None whatsoever. This is a game that I'm staying so far away from, but I'm so intrigued to see it.
You might not be the only one when you consider this number open 1.5 and hasn't budged. I mean, there are some twos available out here in Las Vegas and throughout Nevada, but that's really all I see. I mean, 1.5, more or less the consensus, and it's painted absolutely everywhere.
I haven't seen or heard the one guy that doesn't like Texas Tech that I speak to that's extremely sharp. Says he actually leans Texas Tech here. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I thought you were going to be on Purdue. And he said, no. He's like, I'm not betting it, but I definitely lean Texas Tech. And I went over this matchup and we kind of poured through some of the numbers and in their deficiency, their defensive efficiency rating with Haas off the floor and all those things. And it's significantly better with him off the floor. So, you know, initial gut said, hey, Purdue might have a shot here, just being able to play an efficient style of basketball without a big man clogging everything. But that doesn't seem to be the case. I haven't done anything, and a lot of professionals haven't done anything in this game.
Well, I'm probably the worst one to talk to here. You know, I've been a Purdue detractor for quite some time, so I have full intentions that they'll be cutting down the nets with or without Isaac Haas in San
Antonio. Did you like them a little bit last game? I know it was Butler, and Butler's a little but, you know, they got down early. They're trying to, you know, they were done feeling bad for themselves with Haas being out, and then they turned it on.
I like the way they played. I won't say
I know
that
they didn't
close
strong, obviously. Butler went on, you know, this little mad tear late. But, you know, being down, I think they were down 9 early in that game, and then they got up double digits. It just looked like the offense was flowing a little bit better. And Edwards was in foul trouble for most of that game, too.
Yeah, they did show some capabilities and versatility there, handling some of that adversity rather well. So not going to take anything away from Coach Painter's bunch. on their ability to get here. But much like you, a game that I'll be fascinated to watch to try and figure out who can punch their ticket to take on the winner of West Virginia and Villanova. Two games remaining, Payne, Bob, in the Midwest region that'll take place in Omaha, Nebraska. The early game, as we go out of rotation, is actually Clemson and Kansas. So
let's save that one.
We'll start with Syracuse and Duke. I mean, we talked about how Syracuse got here. We know both teams now employing the 2-3 zone. A fascinating interview earlier this week with Dan Patrick talking to Coach Boeheim. And Coach Boeheim was honest. He said, yeah, publicly I would have said that I think we can go have a chance to cut down the nets. But privately I would have said that I think Jamie Dixon's understanding of how we employ the zone would have ultimately been our undoing. First conference showdown between them, 60-44 win by Duke, where they only shot 2 of 18 from beyond the arc. What is going to be the primary matchup here when you're looking to try and find an edge handicapping Duke against Syracuse?
I can tell you, Jamie Dixon did a very bad job against that zone.
I don't know what Jamie Dixon did. It did look like TCU hadn't seen a damn thing to get ready for that one.
He had, I believe it was, you're all right over there.
I'm a little bit choked up. I'm not going to lie. A little bit choked up. Syracuse is still playing basketball on the second weekend.
You can go to the dog doctor. I know you have one of those now. Pull a little Kramer. You get on your dog meds.
I mean, do you want to go to a doctor that just treats humans, or he treats dogs, fish, guinea pigs, cats, you name it? That's the guy I want to go to, but I don't think I want to take those giant pills he gave Smuckers.
So we were on TCU in that game for that exact reason, and it was nice to see Boeheim come out and have the same exact thought process as we did. And Jamie Dixon, we had charted this, he had like 23 attempts at facing that zone throughout his years, and it looked like it was his very first time. So not a very good performance there from TCU. When I look at this, I think a lot of things have changed, and that's how we've kind of handicapped this. Duke kind of just started going to the zone the first time they had played. It was also Bagley's first game back, so I think he's more acclimated. I think defensively they've gotten a little bit more accustomed to what they're doing and where they should be. They didn't have a great outing against North Carolina's offense. We touched on that last podcast where they gave up like 35 of 42 uncontested shots, but I don't know if Syracuse can do enough here offensively, but they are trending in the right direction with a lot of freshmen. Brissett has really taken that next step, three-star freshman. We didn't think he'd be this good, but he's really, really been outstanding in this tournament. And I know a lot of people have made some fun of Dolaje. He's a foreign kid from Slovakia. Like, at this day and age in 2018, you get a white foreign kid on a team, and he could be a little uncomfortable. He doesn't want to take shots. He doesn't want to be the guy responsible for mistakes. Battle and Howard went to him and said, listen, you need to be more aggressive. If you went back and watched the first Duke game, he's getting the ball at Cameron in spots to score and spots to be effective, and he was just so hesitant. He was afraid to make a mistake. That has not been the case this tournament, and that's why they're really advancing. He's taken that next step. He's been a double-digit scorer. He's very polished. I'm shocked. He's kind of their glue guy right now. And so we've thought throughout this time, it's got to be Battle and Howard. If you can get Battle, Howard, Brissett, and then Dolaje going, that's a big ask. I think also this team with depth issues is going to be a factor here. You know, could be some potential foul trouble, which is going to hinder Syracuse. But from a fatigue factor, again, the time off, I think, is very helpful. But when you looked at that first game, I went back and watched it. At no point did Syracuse ever have a prayer to win that game. It was 8-10-12 virtually the entire way. Duke shot 2 for 18 from 3, and yet they still covered. The pace of play, right, was exactly where Syracuse wants it to be. You hold Duke to 60 and Cameron, you're feeling great about yourself. Still couldn't cover the 14. So that scares me a little bit here.
When I look at this particular game and I try and figure out Syracuse, you mentioned pace of play, their totals. Three games so far this tournament, all coming in comfortably under the number. Am I nuts to think the books haven't adjusted enough, or is 133 an accurate reflection of where this game should be? But if it's played in that range, asking Syracuse to eclipse 60 points and cover as an 11.5-point dog feels like a very, very tall mountain for them to climb.
I think you're heading in the right direction. When you can go and win a game against Michigan State and your team total under still cashes, it tells you a lot about things, right? Their team total was 58.5, 59 against Michigan State. They get the W, they score 55. I saw 61 as a team total. Very intriguing.
Yeah, when I look at this game, I mean, I feel for me personally, only one way to look. I've been a little bit surprised to see early betting indications that show public money backing Syracuse taking those generous points. And I can't really fault folks, I guess, who watched them win outright in a game against Michigan State where the number
covered three
eight,
straight, too. So they've
ten
gotten them.
What'd you say?
Covered three straight. So they've gotten betters to the window, and that's what they remember last. And all of a sudden you see this big price. You're probably going to you're not going to buck the lady you took to prom, right? Syracuse has gotten folks to the window three straight times.
And keep in mind, they've taken professional money against them in all three of those contests and still able to get to the window. Final game of the weekend, as far as we're concerned in the round of 16, Pitt's Kansas against Clemson. I don't want to call it quite a home game pain in Omaha, but it will be a de facto pro-Kansas crowd against the Tigers. And you're looking at this game that opened four, Kansas now a 4.5-point favorite, total 142.5. Clemson, arguably the most impressive performance of the round of 32, absolutely dismantling Auburn, despite that game being bet from Clemson plus one, upwards of 2.5, winning by 31. Clemson offensively so far through two games this tournament, averaging 1.11 points per possession in their win against New Mexico State and a gaudy 1.18 against Auburn. Do we think they'll be able to get anywhere close to trying to replicate that offensive efficiency against Bill Self and the Kansas
Jayhawks? Giving a lot of credit to beating a dead horse, huh?
I mean, every now and again you have to.
We talked last week about price and matchup being the two biggest keys when handicapping this tournament and how there's not a lot of spots. This to me feels like we have a little bit of a situation here. We had Clemson. They struggled down the stretch. I think they lost 5 of 8. They just weren't the same team without Grantham once he went down. They had Shelton Mitchell. He missed a few games in February. He's back. Certainly that's helpful. But Clemson had the easiest path to the Sweet 16 of anybody. And I know everyone got...
How dare you talk poorly about the New Mexico State? Yeah,
how hyped was that 12 seed? I think we just get in this realm of trying to find that 12-5, and every single talking head on your television is picking that 12-5 because they love New Mexico State because they won six straight against teams outside the top 200. Quite frankly, professionals faded every single stage of New Mexico State throughout the WAC tournament. You then beat up on that dead horse in Auburn by 31. I just don't value either of those wins, and I think they're playing a huge role in this number here.
When you try and figure out Kansas and their upside, I mean, this is a team, I'll be honest, has really plagued me a little bit. Went against them in the Big 12 championship. I know we talked about where West Virginia closed the favorite. Wasn't sure what to expect of Kansas against Penn. Took 15. That game didn't quite work out. And then Kansas arguably should have covered against Seton Hall, a game that bailed out some of the books and some of the dog backers. But when you look at this Kansas team, aside from Devontae Graham, do they do anything that leaves you brimming with confidence as they start to step up the class in competition?
Listen, you know, Kansas played horribly against Seton Hall, and I expected they would. Angel Delgado feasted down low, as I talked about that he would, right? I think he became the second player in NCAA tournament history to have 20-20 against a number one seed. The other guy is a two-time NBA champion and has a nickname of The Dream. So I just didn't think that was a very good matchup. I think Kansas is certainly feeling fortunate to move on. Seton Hall probably wins that game if Desi Rodriguez and Sanigo are close to 100% healthy. And I think they know that. I think that was their wake-up call. You mentioned earlier the quick trip here. It's about 4.5 hours. It's going to be predominantly all Kansas. These should be semi-home games. I like that Azubuike has had another 6 days to further heal that knee. I like the progress. He went from playing 3 minutes against Penn, then 22 against Hall. So I think his wind is getting back up there. I like what Bill Self has done. And I know we give a lot of crap to Bill Self for not being the best X's and O's coach, but he's a fantastic motivator. He has a staff that is fantastic. He knows his limitations and he has a great staff, and give him credit. This isn't how he usually runs his team, but he's gone to a four guard lineup. And it seems to be working. Vic is hitting shots. Newman's hitting shots. I mean, Graham played, I know he had 9 assists, but he also had 5 turnovers, didn't score the ball, missed.
He was terrible. He was terrible against Seton Hall.
He wasn't very good against Seton Hall. I just think this was a pretty big wake-up call. This number tells you that that Kansas is the side here, and at four there was professional money. Probably still some value here at 4.5. You don't want to get too far out there, you know, that key number of five. But I like Kansas. And this will be Malik the time, though. Really been... Kansas isn't red hot from three.
You mentioned Malik Newman. He's really been the guy that I've been impressed with picking up some of the scoring slack and giving Kansas another option they can come to count on. Payne, does Kansas ever play an NCAA tournament game more than 6 hours from Fog Allen Fieldhouse? I ask that question legitimately. I feel like every year it's Wichita, it's Omaha, it's Kansas City. I mean, this team never seems to have to travel all that far to get to a Final Four.
This is partly why I'm not a huge Kansas fan. They, you know, Bill Self's got nudes of somebody. Everything lines up picture perfect. There are little things throughout the course of a game that the casual fan might not see, right? There's a foul in, you know, early in the game, or there's something that transpires, you know, before halftime that has just this huge lasting impact potentially later in that game. I mean, there are situations where I believe it got to a 4-point game against Seton Hall, and Miles Powell drives to the lane and finishes a great, great finish. And Mitch Lightfoot literally clubs him in the face. Not only should it have been an and one, but it's probably a flagrant one foul where they're getting two additional shots and the ball back at this crucial stage. And not only is there no flagrant one foul called, there's no foul called at all. And every single break seems to go Kansas's way. For my sake, I hope it continues this week.
Well, let's hope it does in the round of 16. I'd love nothing more than to see the tournament put into quite a quandary, trying to figure out which elite blue blood program they'd have to give the edge to if we do see Duke against Kansas in the Elite Eight, which leads me to kind of one of the last
that
questions
would be
before we get to the best.
In pick 'em.
Best investment. I'm not sure it's going to be a pick 'em. I have to imagine Duke's going to open a short favor in that particular spot. But of all the potential matchups we could see in the Elite Eight, I mean, as a basketball fan, a basketball purist, Payne, Duke-Kansas notwithstanding, what are some of the games that you'd be most intrigued to watch? Not necessarily from a betting standpoint, as we know we kind of tipped our hand a little bit on the round of 32, but just from the power numbers and what it might be in a contrast.
Don't
to
you
size.
Have to think it's got to be the powers of Loyola Chicago and Kansas State? No, I'm kidding. I'm completely kidding. I would love to.
What an absolute mess that'd be, but I'm not going to take anything away from two teams playing their way into contention.
I think Gonzaga, Michigan would be interesting. But I think, obviously, Duke, Kansas is the game, and I think there'd be potential value there for not only for us to watch the game from a fan perspective, but with Kansas's home court advantage being factored in a little bit there, getting Duke and Kansas. And be interesting to see how that zone would work up against a four guard lineup where, you know, all guys are shooting between, you know, 38% and 46%. So that would be an intriguing matchup there. I usually like to go off the radar, but Duke Kansas would be fantastic to see.
Yeah, when I try and go through, I mean, I'd love to see West Virginia get the best of Nova, a game I'm not invested in right now, but would love to see it. And then West Virginia potentially taking on Texas Tech again in a rubber match. Given how competitive they've been, I think, you know, you mentioned it. You know, what might be more interesting, Kentucky, than the winner of, you know, knowing Kentucky's pedigree against Nevada and Loyola to try and see where books elected to open that number? It almost feels when you talk about Kentucky, they're 6-point favorites against anybody because that's pretty much where they've been against Buffalo, Davidson, and, of course, Kansas State this weekend. But, all right, we've taken care of breaking all the games down. I know a lot of people are probably going, wow. Only 8 games on the slate. You guys covered all of them because that's not typically bet the board style by any stretch of the imagination. If we're making one investment or trying to find a way to get to the window in the round of 16, Payne, which particular game is going to get your share of the bankroll?
Let's go with the Jayhawks. Let's go with Kansas. 4.5 would be my last number to grab. I don't want to lay 5 here. Potentially, if you're hearing this closer to game day and we do get to 5, I would wait live. We've seen Kansas start a bit slow, then come on. So maybe you enter it that way. This will be a game that we've already laid 4, but it'll be a game that I'm also probably looking to play live as well if they get down early in addition to my pregame position. So we like Kansas this week.
Rock Chalk Jayhawk. I can't wait till we see what our Bet the Board interns decide they want to put out. Should Kansas get us to the winner's circle with a comfortable double-digit victory against the Clemson Tigers? Thankful for those folks that have followed Tigers basketball. Spring practice underway, and Dabo Swinney looking to try and put another winning product back on the field. But all right, Payne, we've done a lot of the heavy lifting, broken down every game in its entirety, kind of tipped our hand a little bit in terms of what games we'd like to see in the Elite Eight. Should we be so fortunate? Any final tidbits, words of wisdom for our listeners before they go blindly into betting the Sweet 16 with four big days of basketball on the horizon?
I think I'm going to go take a nap. You sound like you could use some sleep and some medicine.
Oh, and I need a little bit of medicine, maybe some bourbon to go a long way, record a couple of videos for Sports Illustrated, hammer out some content
was
there.
Was that the humble brag there on the way out the door?
No, it wasn't really a humble brag. I don't think anybody watches the show that we're doing, so it's kind of fun to try and produce content for air. But if my producers are out there, I love all of you, so I encourage folks to tune in. But it's been a labor of love, as it always is here for Bet the Board podcast. So for Payne Insider, follow him on Twitter at Payne Insider. I am Todd Furman. You can follow me on Twitter as well. And of course, at Bet the Board Pod. Same time next week, Payne, as we break down the Final Four and maybe an NIT championship game for our listeners.
Yeah, that's right. Man, I forgot about that. I was sailing off on vacation Monday. I was gone, but I think they maybe pulled me back in.
You'll have to postpone it at least another week, and then you're allowed to take a brief sabbatical during the summer and spring months. So regardless of which way you elect to bet these upcoming contests, hopefully your brackets remain intact. For Payne Insider, I'm Todd Furman. Best of luck with all of your wagers, and hopefully we'll see you at the window.